before the situation got out of hand, Stasi leader Erich Mielke insisted on East Germany having its own Tiananmen Square massacre. The situation here now is comparable and must be countered by all means and methods, he told his subordinates. But the East German leadership was still torn to the point of paralysis. By September 18, 1989, the Leipzig protesters numbered 15,000 marchers. The Stasi arrested 100 of them, running over others as they sped away. But that did little to stop the masses and did much to further alienate the population from the regime. In between East Germany and Hungary, both geographically and politically, stood Czechoslovakia. Czechoslovakian leader Miloš Jakeš had temporarily closed his border with the GDR to make it more difficult for East Germans to use his country as a throughway to Hungary and then to the West. Now he had a problem with all the East Germans remaining in Prague. They were overwhelming the West German embassy and something had to give. And ailing Honecker came up with a solution so bizarre and out of touch that only a government bureaucrat could have conceived of it. He cut a deal with the Czechoslovakian authorities and the West Germans to allow the East German refugees to emigrate. The one condition was that they had to return to the GDR in order to travel west, handing in their ID cards and losing their East German citizenship in the process. The migrants were confused. Surely this was a trap. And if not a trap, what was the catch? Giving up East German citizenship for West German citizenship and passports at the price of being called a traitor to Honecker's regime? It took the West Germans some effort to persuade the refugees to trust them. Soon, in an almost perfect inversion of World War II, train cars packed full of refugees began to be deported from East Germany, except in this case, they were making their way west and to freedom. After that, thousands more began to drive their East German cars to Czechoslovakia. The timing could not have been worse for Honecker. October 7, 1989 was the date of a massive nationwide event to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the founding of the German Democratic Republic. Part of the event featured a visit from Gorbachev, and the Soviet leader did not mince words in his speech. When he insisted that life punishes those who fall behind, it was clearly a passive-aggressive slap at Honecker, who could only sit there and bite his tongue at the humiliation in front of his colleagues. When the torch-lit procession passed the dais where all the leaders sat, the chants from the marchers, East Germany's most politically reliable citizens, were clearly heard by all. "Gorby, help us," they pleaded. "Help us." Gorbachev's German was poor, but he understood what they were saying. He also understood even better than Honecker himself how quickly the political geography was changing in East Germany. There were still almost 400,000 Soviet troops stationed in the GDR. The evening after Gorbachev left, their commander received a phone call with orders from the Soviet ambassador. "Do not interfere in any way with internal GDR developments. Let them take their course." Double-checking with Moscow resulted in a confirmation of the orders. Regardless of what was to happen in East Germany, the Russians would be on the side of peace. That same evening, demonstrations erupted throughout the GDR by citizens who had realized that Gorbachev was on their side and not Honecker's, and that their authority strength was decreasing. Over 1,000 people were arrested throughout the following day in Berlin alone, many beaten by the Stasi, both publicly and behind closed doors. But what was 1,000 people in a nation of over 16 million. Matters reached a peak the following night on October 9, 1989. There were 8,000 people at St. Nicholas Church alone, far too many to fit inside. The Stasi were ready for them, and so were members of the military. Bloodshed was not just a possibility, but a promise. "We will fight these enemies of our country, if necessary, with arms," read an editorial in the Leipzig Communist Party newspaper. The army was stationed on the route of the demonstration, and the men were handed pistols and plenty of ammunition. Many of the young soldiers burst into tears because they knew that their wives or parents or siblings were planning on marching that night, some with their children, and they knew what their guns could do to them. Some did their best to warn their families, but to what end? If it wasn't their own mother, it would be someone else's. They had enlisted to protect their country and now were being asked to murder families for walking down the street. By 5 o'clock, there were over 70,000 protesters outside the church. Local party officials called Berlin repeatedly, hoping for a peaceful resolution. It was Helmut Hockenberg, second secretary of the party district leadership, who finally made the call, both figuratively and literally. He decided that there would be no force used. He eventually connected with Honecker's second-in-command, Egon Krenz, on the phone and got him to agree. All the government forces in Leipzig were told to take no active actions against persons if there were no anti-state activities and attacks against security forces, objects, and facilities. And so the Leipzigers lit their candles and marched. They held up signs insisting that they wanted peaceful change. The Stasi had spent decades infiltrating protest groups, but the East Germans had also spent decades learning their tricks. When Stasi officers in plain clothes broke their cover and tried to pull people's banners away, they were swiftly surrounded by the crowd. The chant was steady and the same. "We are the people. No violence." It was the largest protest East Germany had ever seen. Footage of the march was aired on West German television, and swiftly all of the GDR was aware of what was going on and how nothing was being done to stop it. Leipzig earned the nickname of Heldenstadt, Hero City. Now the politicians began to speak up. Leipzig's mayor asked for dialogue, as did the mayor of Dresden, which sat just by the border with Czechoslovakia. Many in the party leadership knew that a change was necessary. Things could have swiftly gotten out of control in myriad ways. Another Tiananmen Square was right around the corner as long as Honecker remained in charge. A quiet revolt was organized behind the cancerous man's back. On the following Monday, October 16th, over 120,000 people came out to protest. The ones who had understandably been afraid had now seen for themselves that no one had been harmed the previous week, neither by the Stasi nor by the military. The GDR's top officials watched the live footage for themselves that evening, broadcast from West Germany, of course. They heard the same chants: "We are the people, no violence." But now they also heard a new chant: "Down with the wall." Honecker sat there with his men and repeated the same thing over and over. "Now, surely something has to be done," he insisted. Among the men in the room was Colonel General Fritz Strzelec, chief of staff of the army. Strzelec was no weakling and no dove, to put it mildly. As a member of the Nazi Wehrmacht, he had spent over 3 years as a Soviet prisoner after World War II. He was and remained a committed communist. But Strzelec looked at Honecker and, as tactfully as possible, told the East German ruler to go fuck himself. "We can't do anything," Strzelec said. "We will let the whole thing take its course peacefully." The next morning, the East German Communist Party leadership had a meeting. Just as had been planned, Prime Minister Willy Stoff interjected as soon as everyone was called to order. "I suggest a new first item be placed on the agenda," he said. "It is the release of Erich Honecker from his duties as General Secretary and the election of Egon Krenz in his place." Honecker did not react. There was no precedent for this, and it caught him entirely by surprise. Sensing the mood in the room, knowing that he couldn't simply ignore Stoff's request, he turned to those he had regarded as his most loyal allies, but Honecker had no allies left. One by one, as they had planned, all the men in the room took turns using their words to denounce the man, stabbing him not in the back, but in the front. The vote was unanimous because Honecker, being a good communist, accepted the decision of the collective and voted against himself as well. After he left party headquarters, he phoned the Soviet ambassador to let him know the news. Then he called Margot as well. She herself would be sacked as education minister a few weeks later. The GDR elite thought that, by sacrificing the despised Honecker to the masses, they would have a honeymoon period under Krenz's leadership. In this, they were as out of touch as Honecker himself had grown. It was Krenz who had been shown repeatedly on East German television shaking hands with the Chinese leadership after Tiananmen Square. The week after Honecker's ouster, over 1 million East Germans took to the streets in continuing protests. On November 1st, Krenz flew to Moscow to meet with Gorbachev, who viewed him as another Honecker. The new East German leader had two big items to discuss. First, he had learned that the GDR's finances were completely disastrous. A majority of the machines being used industrially were write-offs, meaning that the cost to repair them outweighed any benefit. Worse, East Germany was days away from defaulting on interest payments on foreign loans. Once that happened, getting further credit would be close to impossible and economic collapse virtually certain. Austerity measures akin to Romania's rationing were not a viable solution, not when 1 million East Germans out of a nation of roughly 16.5 million were already taking to the streets. "Would the Soviet Union help bail them out, please? After all," Krenz said, "the GDR is in a sense the child of the Soviet Union, and one must acknowledge paternity of one's children." Gorbachev refused and instead argued for more reforms in the vein of what he had introduced into the Soviet Union. Above all, he urged Krenz to embrace glasnost, openness, and level with the East German people about the financial situation instead of continuing with the decades of lies. Now Krenz used the obfuscatory language of a bureaucrat to hold his citizens hostage. If what was happening in Leipzig hit Berlin, then it was quite possible the Berliners might storm the wall itself. That would be awful, Krenz pointed out, because then the police would have to intervene, and certain elements of a state of emergency would have to be introduced. In other words, he was threatening Gorbachev with unleashing the power of the East German state against his own people. Disgusted, Gorbachev sent Krenz back to East Berlin empty-handed. Then Gorbachev sent a memo to the heads of the Soviet forces stationed in the GDR, reminding them to do absolutely nothing to intervene if matters took a turn for the worse there. That same day, the East German government reopened its border with Czechoslovakia in an attempt to demonstrate that things had changed from the Honecker era. Prague, on the other hand, had followed Hungary's lead and simply opened their own border to West Germany in order to get all the refugees off their hands. Within 3 days, over 50,000 East Germans drove their way to the West via Czechoslovakia. It was like a dam had been breached and now a second hole had burst open. 3 days later, Krenz's prediction to Gorbachev came true. Over 700,000 Berliners took to the streets once again under the slogan of "We are the people." Some political figures tried to co-opt the energy, but the masses were not having it. Even dialogue with the communist government following the Polish model would no longer satisfy the people. Propaganda chief Gunter Schabowski took to the platform in a show of support for the crowds, but was booed off the stage. The audience did not yet appreciate that they were booing the man who would soon be their liberator. On November 8th, Helmut Kohl met with Lech Walesa in Poland to discuss the ongoing situation throughout Central Europe. Walesa had seen how quickly Poland transformed from a totalitarian state into the beginnings of a liberal parliamentary democracy. "You know," Walesa said, "the wall will come down soon. I don't know when, but I really think very soon, maybe weeks." Kohl laughed in his face. "You're young and don't understand some things," he told Walesa, who was 46. "There are long historical processes going on, and this will take many years." Both men were wrong. The imagery of thousands of citizens camped out as refugees had been enormously humiliating to the GDR's international prestige. The new East German government attempted a novel approach to try and control the massive number of citizens that were fleeing the country. Having no really good options, it was decided that they would be allowed to emigrate if they asked for permission while in East German soil. Then, at least, the authorities would still have some measure of control over the whole mess and could possibly be able to hide the extent of the situation from the outside world. Another attempt by the new government to provide the appearance of fundamental reform was by fielding open questions from reporters. On November 9th, Schabowski accordingly held his daily press conference. After an hour of talking with the press, he said that he had time for one more question. Word had gotten around that there were new travel regulations under consideration, and the media wanted to know more. Schabowski was prepared for this, having spoken to Krenz about the issue immediately beforehand. Krenz had even given him a copy of the decree to look over. Schabowski explained that, "We find it unacceptable that this movement is taking place across the territory of an allied state, which is not an easy burden for that country to bear. Therefore, we have decided today to implement a regulation that allows every citizen of the German Democratic Republic to leave the GDR through any of the border crossings." Then he read from the draft text that Krenz had handed him. "Applications for travel abroad by private individuals can now be made without the previously existing requirements of demonstrating a need to travel or proving familial relationships. The travel authorization will be issued within a short time. Grounds for denial will only be applied in particular exceptional cases. The responsible departments of passport and registration control in the People's Police District offices in the GDR are instructed to issue visas for permanent exit without delays and without presentation of the existing requirements for permanent exit. Permanent exit is possible via all GDR border crossings to the FRG. These changes replace the temporary practice of issuing authorizations through GDR consulates and permanent exit with a GDR personal identity card via third countries." When asked when this new policy was to take effect, a nervous Schabowski shuffled through his documents. He didn't notice the sentence on the back of one paper embargoing the information until the following morning. "That comes into effect," he replied, "according to my information, immediately, without delay." "Does this also apply for West Berlin?" one journalist asked. Schabowski shrugged and then, frowning, looked back at his papers. He reread the key passage. "Permanent exit can take place via all border crossings from the GDR to the FRG in West Berlin, respectively." In other words, the propaganda chief of East Germany announced live on camera that East Berliners were free to leave to West Berlin without any fear of repercussions. Not only did he announce it, but he had repeated it for good measure. The Berlin Wall was effectively now just a concrete structure. The East German broadcast of the press conference began at 7:30 p.m., and the East Berliners began to storm the wall immediately thereafter. The guards had heard different rumors themselves and were left unsure of what to do. "Open the gate," chanted the people. "The wall must go." For the first time in their lives, the citizens felt comfortable arguing with soldiers and Stasi officers, and they were safe to do so. The armed men argued back, but there was no move on their part to escalate matters to violence. It was a little after 9 p.m. when word came down from the bureaucracy. The more aggressive citizens were to be let through, but they should not expect to be allowed to return back. They were effectively not emigrating, but being deported. To the East Berliners, those terms were acceptable. By this point, all six East Berlin border checkpoints were mobbed, with 20,000 people at the Bornholmerstrasse checkpoint alone. Harold Jaeger, the border guard commander stationed there, made a professional assessment of the situation. "All I was thinking about now was to avoid bloodshed," he later explained. "There were so many people and they didn't have space to move. If a panic started, people would have been crushed. We had pistols. I had given instructions not to use them, but what if one of the men had lost his nerve?" Jaeger made an executive decision. He ordered his men to open the gate. 1 hour later, unaware of what had happened at Bornholmerstrasse, border guard commander Gunter Moll independently made the same decision at the notorious checkpoint Charlie Crossing. As a deluge of his countrymen ran past him to West Berlin, abandoning their cars behind them, he stood there wondering why the hell the crossing had ever been closed to begin with. The video footage of the young border guards stepping aside as hundreds of East Berliners ran past them is particularly notable for one big reason. For once, the guards were smiling. The citizens of the GDR were greeted in West Berlin with flowers and champagne by their fellow Germans. By midnight, all six checkpoints were wide open, with all 12,000 border guards sent back to their barracks. Soon, the entire world was watching in shock as residents of a united Berlin were literally dancing atop the Berlin Wall. There were still some half-hearted attempts to get them down. The East German police at one point tried to blast them off with a hose, only to be defeated by an umbrella. Helmut Kohl, who wasn't young but nevertheless still didn't understand some things, cut his trip to Poland short. "I'm at the wrong party," he said. Nobody thought to phone Moscow until 5 a.m., and even then no one bothered to call Gorbachev. He only learned what had happened when he woke up the following morning to scenes that seemed unimaginable. He called Krenz to give his consent after the fact. "You made the right decision, because how could you shoot Germans who walk across the border to meet other Germans?" he said. Gorbachev still didn't quite realize that it hadn't really been Krenz's decision so much as a historic accident on Schabowski's part. Stuck in between Hungary and East Germany was Czechoslovakia, but Communist Party leader Miloš Jakeš intended to stay the course. "As long as the economy holds up here," he had told his colleagues, "we'll be all right." Just to be sure nothing went wrong, he increased patrols in areas used for popular gatherings or uprisings. But there was one popular gathering that the Czech authorities could not quash: the 50th anniversary of the murder of Jan Opeltal. Opeltal was a 24-year-old medical student shot by the Nazis for protesting against their occupation of Czechoslovakia. It was the Czech communists themselves who had propagandized him as a martyr in the decades following World War II. The anniversary march proceeded as planned on Friday, November 17, 1989, 8 days after the Berlin Wall was opened. The crowds held banners denouncing communism, commemorating the Prague uprising of 1968, but the police did nothing. When the march ended, most of the crowd dispersed, except for a group of mostly students who then made their way to Prague's historic Wenceslas Square. As they approached the square, they found their way blocked by both riot police and anti-terrorist squads, batons at the ready. The protesters gave the police their candles and they gave the police their flowers. They sat down in the street, chanting, "We have no weapons," and singing songs. Then another group of riot police came up behind them. They were trapped on the street for 2 hours, singing songs in the freezing cold. When they asked if they could go home, the police said nothing. It was at 9 p.m. when a riot squad van arrived and began ramming into them. That's when the police began their beatings. Over 500 people were injured, men, women, and children alike, and the 120 who were arrested were thereupon beaten again. Supposedly there was one casualty, but the lesson of Jan Opeltal was that the life of one student can make a powerful difference. Rumors in communist nations were often far more truthful than any official media source, and soon a story got out that the police had murdered a student by the name of Martin Schmidt. Foreign media outlets such as the BBC and Voice of America reported the unverified story as fact. There were, in reality, two students by the name of Martin Schmidt studying at Prague's Charles University at that time, and the government swiftly produced them both to demonstrate that they were perfectly safe and unharmed. After over 4 decades of communist rule, the authorities actually were telling the truth, and after over 4 decades of communist rule, the people did not believe them. Now that the authorities had chosen violence, everything was on the table. That weekend saw demonstrations that hadn't been seen in Prague since 1968, with the spot where the police had beaten the protesters taking on the form of a secular shrine. Students were now joined by every type of citizen, and all that the government could think to do in response was to arrest the activist who had spread the claim that Schmidt had been killed. The Czech analog to Lech Walesa was Václav Havel, their version of the dissident figurehead who fought the authorities for decades while getting arrested and subsequently released. A prominent playwright, Havel's career was destroyed due to his support of the Prague Spring. His words were banned in Czechoslovakia, while he himself was forbidden from leaving the country. Havel had suspected that the end of the Berlin Wall meant that things would change swiftly in Czechoslovakia as well, and he returned to Prague from the countryside to take part in the escalating drama. Havel began to organize at a theater with the fortuitous name of the Magic Lantern. The protesters called themselves the Civic Forum and presented themselves as spokesmen for the people. They issued 4 demands. 1. The resignation of the leaders who had crushed the Prague Spring. 2. The resignation of the ministers who had ordered the attacks on the students. 3. An independent inquiry into the recent events. 4. The immediate release of all political prisoners. The protests grew and continued over the following days. The energy was felt in every segment of the country. Actors went on strike and so did the football players. The Monday alone after the police violence saw 300,000 protesters. A new symbol of defiance arose, holding up keys and shaking them in the air, telling the communists to pack their crap and leave. The Magic electric lantern became a beacon to a wide swath of ideologies which had one agenda in common, freeing Czechoslovakia from Communist Party rule. This was to be a revolution, but a soft and peaceful one. It became known as the Velvet Revolution for just that reason. The authorities considered sending in the tanks, not the Russian ones this time, but their own. This was the position Defense Minister Yaroslav Vaklevich,